Welcome to the Rocks Back Pages podcast. My name is Barney Hoskins. I'm here with Mark Pringle.
Hi, Barney.
Hello, Mark. Mark and I are sitting here with our very special guest, Lucy O'Brien. Welcome.
Hello, Lucy.
Hello. Hello.
Lovely to have you here, Lucy.
Lovely to be here.
And you're here for a number of reasons, but mainly because, well, we love you. But also, this very week, I believe, sees the publication of a fully revised and updated edition of your classic Dusty Springfield biography. So congratulations on that.
You.
It is this week or next week?
This week, yeah. It's
great.
Just been published, literally just a couple of days ago. And I'm thrilled, actually, because Michael O'Mara, the publisher, they've done this amazing job on it. It looks really beautiful, but then Dusty, you know, had this real kind of ethereal beauty about her.
Yeah.
But they've kind of presented it in a way that's really accentuated her iconic status.
Yeah.
Quite right. We'll be talking about a lot of women on this podcast,
yeah,
including you. Well, mainly you.
Yes.
But just to sort of flag up, we'll be talking, we hope to be talking a little bit about Madonna, a little bit about Skunk and Nancy, Skin, a little bit about Taylor Swift. The week's audio interview is with Alicia Keys from 2010. So we're hoping to be talking about all of those things.
Yeah.
I'd like to just start by just going back, obviously, to like the NME days. Mm. That's probably when I first met you. We'd have been in the 80s. You were on the NME.
Yeah.
You arrived shortly after. Well, we sort of passed slightly like ships in the night because I was on my way out and you were on your way in. But I do, I remember, I mean, if you go to Lucy's Wikipedia page, it talks about these sort of factions within the NME. Mm. And I do remember being, I was still allowed to sit in on editorial meetings. Mm. And I do remember the just slightly factional atmosphere within. You all remember that too.
Yes.
You're probably bored of talking about this.
I'm not bored
but
of talking
you were
about
always,
it.
You were always lovely. Some of them are a bit intimidating, but you there was this little kind of Stuart Cosgrove faction, wasn't there?
Yeah.
What's your memory of that?
Well, so at the time, loosely, there was the faction with myself and Stuart and Sean O'Hagan and Paolo Hewitt.
Yes.
And
socialists.
The socialists.
The socialists.
Would you
still call yourself a socialist?
Gale Force, was it? Stuart called it the Gale Force.
Great.
And I suppose we wrote with a political critique. But then, you know, actually everybody did, really, at that time. But I suppose we were very supportive of Red Wedge and the Labour Party and the artists that were featured in that, like Paul Weller and Billy Bragg. And I think part of the problem was there was a sort of a, at the time, there was a dialectic about what is NME? Is it indie rock? Is it rock? Or is it embracing new emerging black music?
Yeah.
That seemed to be the discourse at the time. But when I look at it now, I actually think... in a way, we were all on the same side, and it was less about music genres, and it was more about a creeping takeover and consumerism and branding of the music press.
Yeah.
That actually, what we were worried about was bigger, you know. And I just remember that week of the general election, I think it was 1987, and we had Neil Kinnock on the cover.
Yeah.
Yes.
No word of a lie, but there was an editorial in the Sunday Express, and I think it was John Juniper who was like the editor, saying, "What is going on at NME?" And this was in the actual editorial column.
Yeah.
"Do the shareholders of Reed International know what is going on?"
Extraordinary.
It was extraordinary.
Yeah.
It's like this massive intervention from on high.
I come from political left anyway, so my background. That was an aspect of the NME I was very, very comfortable with. I mean, having read the underground press, which is inherently as much about politics as anything.
Yes.
And in a way, the NME, as we knew it then, had developed out of the underground press with the Mick Farrans and the Charlie Murrays.
Out of that counterculture.
Mm. Yeah, yeah,
yes.
We could do with a bit more of that now, couldn't we, really?
Yes.
I mean, things are so much more perilous and frightening now. And where are the voices?
Well, I mean, but then you just had the miners' strike
and the Whopping, News International.
And the cruise missiles, Greenham Common, all of that stuff going on.
A lot of agitation.
There was a lot.
It was a very tense atmosphere.
Yeah.
And actually, the Tories won. Believe it or not, they actually had a majority at that point, unlike now. But, you know, they had a majority. So I think they felt very entitled to come down really, really hard on anyone who was expressing left-wing opinion in the mainstream media.
Yes.
So you guys, you can go and work for Marxism Today or New Statesman, but don't you dare use our magazines in the centre of
Did you get any outside pressure from the publishers, from other people, to tone down the politics of the paper?
Oh, God, yeah, yeah. I mean, there was a page that was called Manifesto. Do you remember that, Barney?
Yeah.
I mean, there were interviews with Martin McGuinness, you know, and there's a friend of mine who said, you know, in the NME, that was one of the few places you could get some really informed discussion of Northern Ireland and what was going on in Northern Ireland. Mm-hmm. And you had interviews with Tony Benn, but also great filmmakers as well. Mm. And it was
and
like
the nearest thing that football got to a socialist was Pat Nevin's interview in the NME.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So you were getting pressure from within...
Oh, yes, yes. So there was a change of editor. Mm. Should we put it, you know... The editor there who was there was moved, and there was a new editor put in place, and then a few section editors were removed as well, including Stuart, and a whole load of freelancers were... Kind of, it was made clear that we weren't really welcome anymore and our work wasn't welcome anymore.
Blimey.
And so it was very swift and very sudden, and it did come right down from the management of IPC.
Was there a specific year when that occurred?
Yeah, it was 1987.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it was like September 1987, and we'd been working on a themed issue called Pop Babylon. It was kind of based on Kenneth Anger's book, Hollywood Babylon,
yeah.
And this was where there was a whole feature about band album sleeves, and there was Geiger's penis landscape image that was going to be printed. This makes me laugh now thinking about it, because I used to go down as a sub to the workshops at Clerkenwell and the printers. And the printers were guys, and they had like page three girls stuck on their walls, and they came in like, and I think, were you just pretending to be outraged? They're coming, we can't possibly print this. And they've got busty page three girls. Really?
Yeah.
You can't print that? Yeah. Really? And then they just use that as an excuse to sort of get rid of a whole load of people and say, you know, this is absolutely so offensive. It's so offensive. They can't print it, you know. And then a few years later, they did print it as part of some kind of themed thing. I think overall the feeling was, or the word came down, that questions were being asked in the parent company, Reed International, is there a socialist cabal operating within NME?
Which
the answer was yes, and had been for quite a long time. Probably since the 1960s, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But they were absolutely prepared to eradicate it.
Yeah. I mean, it's very noticeable that Sands and a Melody Maker at the time, which had many qualities themselves, as papers said, very good writers. But there was virtually none of that, those politics on those two papers.
No. You know?
And that the NME always felt like it was a broader paper than just a music paper.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's what I mean by having interviews with, like, David Cronenberg and J.G. Pallard, for God's sake. Martin Amis. Yeah. I mean, it was David Lynch.
Yeah. It was actually close to what, let's say, The Word was attempting to do as a magazine many years later. Yes. It was just a broader thing.
I mean, in a way, that sort of cuts the heart of it, wasn't it? Because the sales were declining, as they were for everybody.
Yeah.
And I suppose there was this thought that, well, you know, no one quite knows what this paper's supposed to be, you know, what is it?
Yes.
And we need to strip it back down to its kind of core essence, which is, of course, you know, white boys with guitars.
Yeah.
And I mean, not that I was really there anyway. I think probably the last thing I ever wrote for NME would have been about 87, but I wasn't coming in. But there was this sense with C86, the famous cassette and all of that, that, you know, actually that's our real base.
Yeah.
And okay, so there's a cover on Public Enemy, but really it's about white boys with guitars. Yeah. Did you feel that there was a sort of push to, yeah, distill the sort of identity of the paper.
Yes, definitely after that schism, you know, it really yeah. was like the before and after. Mm-hmm. And after then, the emphasis was much more on rock and indie rock. And in a way, they pushed themselves up a cul-de-sac, because I'm not convinced Absolutely. That was the right way to go. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, look at where hip-hop is now. I mean, yeah. it's so yeah. globally dominant.
And sales you know. Continue to decline anyway.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, it wasn't
yes.
as if, oh, well, suddenly we're going to start selling 200,000 yes. yeah. copies a week again.
And it's a different, I mean, it's a, yeah. such a cliche now, media landscape. Yeah, yeah. That phrase, I use that a lot in academia. Changing media landscape. But I think NME could have anticipated that in a different way.
I mean, Melody Maker, there was a schism within the Melody Maker staff, basically black music versus white music.
Yeah,
and Frank Kern reports when he got Public Enemy on the cover, which I guess be 88 or yeah. 80, a huge row in the editorial thing, yes. you know. And there's also this idea that black faces on the covers of magazines reduce sales.
And yes, we were told that too, yeah. you know, and that was something that we had to keep arguing about and saying, well, what's the identity of the paper? Is it just about pleasing people and sales? Mm-hmm. Or wasn't it always about innovation and kind of breaking yeah. new music? And look, this is the new music that's exciting yeah. and that's coming through now.
Yes, exactly.
And that's what gave the magazine its strength.
Given our theme for this week, Lucy, from a female perspective, what was your experience like coming into what at certain points been a boys' club at NME, but there were female writers from quite early on. But how was that experience for you?
Well, I started writing for NME in the early 80s, and it was a bit intimidating at first coming into. I mean, let's face it, it was very male. I wouldn't say people made me feel unwelcome. No, not at all. Mm. But at the same time, it was stringently competitive, and you had to, I mean, you know this, you had to be quite tough with your features and your writing and your sense of self.
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe at that point, men were more used to the rough and tumble of that, whereas I think for women, it might have been a more difficult environment.
Which other women were writing to get paper into?
So at that point,
Cynthia Rose.
Cynthia had been there for a bit longer.
She'd been there a while. And
she'd
then,
been there since the late 70s.
Right.
Yes. And there's Michelle Kirsch.
Of course, great friend of ours, yeah.
She's just wonderful.
Yeah.
And Louise Gray, who I think had been doing something on Melody Maker, and she came over to NME. There weren't many of us.
No.
And then Barbara Ellen started writing for us. And she's got on, she's now got an amazing column.
Absolutely,
doing really well. But my sense was that you had to, because there was a sort of idea that women either A, didn't know that much about music or couldn't really write about it, you had to continually prove yourself.
Yes.
And most, I talked to other female journalists, you know, some maybe just before me, like Vivian Goldman, Caroline Kuhn, who say, well, yeah, you had to be, work twice as hard and be twice as good as the next man to be noticed. And I think that's true.
From my perspective, because I read all this stuff as part of my job here, is that the women's writing stands up not just as well, but frequently considerably better than a lot of the average male pop journalists. And that goes right back to the 60s. I mean, one of my favourite writers we have is Dawn James, who wrote for Rave magazine, an absolutely superb writer. Yes.
And a former podcast
and a
guest.
Former podcast.
Yes. Moreover, she was terrific. Yeah. She was sitting in that very seat for 6 months.
But I mean, it's really striking that you know what you say is absolutely true. And as a result, women journalists were twice as good because they had to be twice as good in a way, you know.
And you had to have staying power because it could be quite off-putting. You know, you really had to kind of stick to your guns. So I think all of us have that. I've noticed, you know, have that sort of quiet determination. No, we'll just keep going. We're just going to keep going. Mm-hmm. And it is quite hard to get further than the foothills. So, you know, you might see a lot of female bylines in the down page reviews, but you won't really see them in the features or the cover features, you know, God forbid. That's where the real, if you want, boys' club really exists.
It's less so than on the editorial staff. I mean, Carol Clark was one of the rare ones who managed to sort of carve out.
Lynn Hanna. And Nick Logan employed quite a few on the face.
Yes.
You know, that was a much more welcoming environment, I suspect. Of course, we can transpose this whole argument to the boys' club of rock and roll itself.
Well, yes.
So I had a question for you, which was, you know, you have written the definitive book on, you know, the what's your subtitle? Definitive History of Women in Rock, Pop and Soul. Shebop, which is now in its, well, I don't know how many iterations.
Third edition. It's going to be 25
fantastic.
Next
year. Well, it's like a Bible. I mean, it really is like the Bible. And, you know, just such a fantastic thing to do. Were you, when did you first think, were you still at the NME when you had this idea that possibly there was a book like this to be written?
Well, it was little seeds. So I was always interested in feminism, and I got myself into trouble at school by bringing spare rib and putting it on tables in the common room. Because I went to a convent school.
Right.
And I remember, isn't youth an amazing thing? I remember putting up a poster for the National Abortion Campaign up. Bloody convent.
That is pure punk rock.
I just did it. And then a nun came in and said, we don't have views like this in this school. And,
well, of course, you had a punk band called The Catholic Girls.
Yes, we were called The Catholic Girls. And we also did a school magazine called Within These Walls, which was named after... Do you remember there was a show on ITV that was about a women's prison, and it was called Within These Walls?
I can remember quite a few women's prison dramas. There was a very famous Australian one, wasn't there? But we won't go there.
Prisoner cell blockade.
You can see there's a theme emerging. So
there is, women, really prisons, and rock and roll.
I was really interested in two things, feminism and music. So
yeah, sure.
I always combine those two things. And I wrote for Spare Rib magazine in the end, and I was writing for NME. And I think every music writer contributes something of themselves, don't they? And, you know, it's like, I think music writing is like a vocation because there's not much money in it. So you do it because you love it. And I suppose what I like to think I brought was some kind of feminist critique in there.
Well, you did. You absolutely did.
And to push it through.
Yeah, yeah.
And so part of that was, I need to interview female artists because they're just not featured enough in the pages, and to try and push for them to have bigger feature space. And so that was my project, if you like, through the time I was there. And so whenever a female artist came to town, I would interview her. Mm. And it was everyone from kind of Patti LaBelle to Chrissie Hynde to, you know, a lot of... And I think in the end, I ended up meeting so many amazing women. Mm. And also after I left NME, and I remember... like meeting Nina Simone, that was a really memorable interview. And then after a while I thought, this is like an archive. Yeah. I've got this archive now.
Yeah.
And it seemed to form itself. It's like there has to be a history now. And I looked around, and at that point there wasn't a history of women in popular music. So I thought, well, it's time to write one then, isn't it? So I got in touch with my friend Margaret, who is an editor at Penguin, and she did a proposal, and she said, yes, right, let's go for it.
Great.
And then, so 1995, that was when it first came out.
Well, let's talk about your first book, and one of the great female pop stars certainly this country's ever produced, Dusty. And we mentioned the new edition of this. I mean, we all worship Dusty Springfield, and it's such a fascinating story of a woman in that era how she coped with a number of issues.
It still is fascinating.
I mean, had you listened to her from when you were a little girl, and what gave you the idea? Dusty biography.
I always loved her hits, and I remember being very struck. This was more when I was in a punk, in my teenage years.
Yeah.
Phillips had released one of these compilation albums that Dusty always hated. But it was a very iconic black and white... Do you remember
I still own it.
Black and white and silvery.
2020 Greatest Hits, I think it was.
And and she had that look where she had her sort of really, really platinum blonde hair and her dark eyes. Mm-hmm. And I remember saying to my friend Claire, I mean, this woman is so enigmatic and so interesting, isn't she?
Yes.
And then she just disappeared. It was like, at that point, I mean, I think it was the late 70s, and she literally just disappeared. Mm. Nobody knew where she was or anything. Mm. So, you know, moving on 10 years, Phonogram released the Silver Collection, and I was lucky enough to interview her at that point and sort of start to find out what was happening. She was about to move from LA back to the UK. She just had that hit with the Pet Shop Boys.
Yes.
What have I done to deserve this?
So suddenly it was like happening for her again.
Yes. Yeah. And I wrote up the interview for City Limits magazine, where I was working at the time. And then an editor at Sidgwick and Jackson got in touch and said, would you like to do a biography? And I was like, whoa, yeah.
Great.
Fantastic.
And that's how it emerged.
Yeah. One of the three pieces that we're featuring is a piece you wrote on Dusty. And, I mean, I checked this, the dates. You wrote this, and she literally died about 3 weeks later. Yeah. Is that correct?
Yes.
I was really struck by that.
Yeah.
Because it's issue date, The Observer, 21st February, 1999. Mm-hmm. Yeah. She died on March the 2nd.
Wow.
I know.
I mean, and you mention like an obituary, in the piece really. That she has inoperable, untreatable breast cancer.
Yes.
But you couldn't have known that she was about to die.
No.
And it's a really nice summation of what made her so great. And
how often did you interview her?
So I interviewed her the once.
Just the once?
In the late 80s.
Right. In the late 80s.
Before you started working with her.
How was she to interview? Yeah.
I always say she stands out to me because I've interviewed quite a few different pop and rock artists and over the years. But what stood out for me was how she genuinely listened to the questions, thought for a bit. She didn't answer straight away. She thought for a bit. And then she gave a really original, thoughtful answer.
Yeah.
And she obviously enjoyed conversation. She enjoyed thinking. Mm-hmm. You know, you really feel that there was a mind at work there.
Yes.
And also very keen sense of humour, quite surreal
Of humour. So before we started this very brief chat, I was saying about in my job, I've been reading interviews with her going right back to when she was with the Springfields.
Yeah.
And as far back as that. And there is a qualitative difference between her being interviewed and just about any other pop star came across.
Yes,
And part of that is the difficulty the interviewers have because they're used to the people coming out with platitudes and she would talk with a remarkable degree of honesty about what she found difficult in different situations.
We were
talking about her nasty experience with Buddy Rich in New York and she came back and talked about that very frankly indeed. What happened with Buddy Rich?
So that's a great... I mean, I think there in a nutshell, you've got what it's like to be a woman in the 1960s in the music business, basically. So she'd been booked to headline. She'd had, you know, this is 1966. A lot of hits. She was booked to play Basin Street East, a residency, and he was supporting her. But obviously his masculine pride couldn't take that, you know.
Yeah.
This English...
Oh, he was an alpha male, wasn't he?
Singer So, first of all, when it came to rehearsals, she asked if she could rehearse with his band because she was going to be playing with the band, and he refused. And then he started getting very uptight about her having top billing and insisted that she should support him. And then they got into a huge argument. But what I find quite funny, I know I shouldn't, is that she hit him, you know, she whacked him round the head and he had a toupee and it went flying.
Oh, dear.
And then at the end of the residency...
He was rude about her on stage, wasn't he?
Oh, and he was rude about her on stage.
Yeah.
But at the end of the residency, his band gave her a pair of boxing gloves with a card saying Slugger Springfield.
That's fabulous.
Wow.
Yeah. That's fabulous.
But you know, I've been thinking about this anew and, you know, in some ways she has been presented as a victim because of her struggles with addiction and mental health issues. And in a way, there was a fragility about her, and that's what comes through in her music. Mm-hmm. But also, there was an incredible determination and fighting spirit there as well that I think needs to be honoured, you know. And more and more, I look at the music industry and what women have to do. Okay, you can have a certain amount of success, but to have sustained success, that's a whole other story.
I mean, one thing that's really striking, there's also a lot of what I've read, is how fastidious she was as a recording artist, that she really, really cared about the art of what she was doing. And she wouldn't just go in, stand behind the mic and sing the song as asked to by a producer. Yes. Sometimes the point of a problem, if it'd been a problem in terms of the process. Yeah, yeah, I mean, famously, and also, you know, she had her insecurities. I think when Jerry Wexler said, "You're standing in front of the microphone, Aretha Franklin stood in front of it." Well, so she just
wasn't the wisest thing to say.
Jerry. Sing after that, you know. But I've loved the fact that, you know, there's all these reports of, you know, her in a studio, and it's, "No, I'm going to do that again. No, I'm going to do that again. I've got to get this right."
It was an incredible perfectionism, and I interviewed Julie Felix for the updated version of the book, and They were friends and they were lovers as well.
Mm.
And Julie said, well, Dusty gave me a lot of advice. And I said, well, what sort of things would she say? And she said, well, there was a record that I put out that she said to me afterwards. She said, Julie, you are out of tune there. You shouldn't have let that record be released. Mm. Oh, well, the producer was in a hurry. Well, you know, you've got to. Speak and up. She was very particular about that, which I thought was quite interesting. You know, she wouldn't let anything go that she thought wasn't quite up to the standard.
I've never heard the album she did after Dusty in Memphis, which is currently very hard to find, which is the one she did in New York, which is a much more comfortable experience.
Yes.
And it's a very different thing.
Yes.
No, I she's a great artist. I mean, it's an astonishing singer. I mean, even the biggest, blousiest of her sort of 60s pop tunes are just fantastic. Yes.
Well, they're great songs. They're incredible arrangements. Yeah. They're, you know, some of them are rather overwrought, but so because she carries it.
Yes.
Yeah. She's just
Overdo it. No. She never overdoes it.
No, she doesn't. Yeah. She doesn't.
So you can have that massive orchestra, but she's so sometimes quite restrained.
You mentioned her sexuality in the piece that I'm talking about here that came out just before she died. You quote a friend of hers and an American songwriter, Ali Willis, saying, without question, the lesbian issue was the icing on the cake of her difficult reputation, quote unquote. Yeah, I mean, and perhaps like banal thing to say is it must have been very difficult to be gay in that swinging 60s era of, you know, Scylla and Lulu and all the others.
Yes.
So do you think it would have been any easier for her today?
That's a good question. I mean, I was talking to a rock manager just recently who was saying, well, you know, actually, she said, I know a lot of women in the industry, certainly in pop, who are either gay or bisexual, who still keep their sexuality hidden because it'll affect their record sales.
Yeah.
Massively affect their record sales.
So that's still the sort of word.
But you see, what happens though is she said that they have an awful lot of mental health issues because that's what it leads to.
This kind of leads on to Skin and Skunk and Nancy. I mean, you know her story very well.
Because that's the third piece, is a profile of Skin from the Telegraph magazine in the summer of 99.
Yes.
And
20 years ago.
Yeah. And you mentioned that she is open about her bisexuality, which has earned her respect and hasn't hindered sales. But I don't know what you would say now.
Well, you know, I've been talking with her recently, and in fact, I saw them, Skunk and Nancy, have just released this massive, like, triple album, 25 live at 25 years since their first gig at the Splash Club in King's Cross. But I think even Skin would say now that, you know, she would never do it any other way. She was always going to be open about her sexuality, but she thinks it did compromise their success, certainly in America.
Also, her skin
made her less marketable. And being a black woman singing in white rock scenario.
Sure.
And she thinks that, you know, it did play against her in lots of ways. And also just in the music press as well, certain.
Which makes her endurance all more remarkable.
Yes.
I mean, saying that it's the same band, the same personnel, 25 years later, still playing together. Yeah.
And I think it's quite interesting. She did go through a period where she had a couple of solo albums in the 2000s, and they were really good, but it was something was missing. And it was when the band got back together, the full power of her voice came to the fore again. Mm-hmm. So it's so interesting, that alchemy that's in a band, and it really works with that lineup.
Try to soothe the face, my face, some face by wicked
of another of your biographical subjects, one cannot say really that this woman has been a victim. I'm talking about Madonna. Like an Icon is your biography that came out in 2007, and we feature a piece which I'm guessing sort of drew on the research you've done, because it's interviews you've done about her, Independence Sunday, September 2007. I mean, we talk about Dusty Springfield. Mm. You know, you can't really think about artists like Dusty Springfield in the same way in a post-Madonna universe. Madonna really did change the paradigm, didn't she?
She did.
I mean, she was tough and determined in a way that perhaps no one had been able to be before.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, there's some great quotes in here about what she was like as a kid. You know, I mean, these terrific, sort of driving around in a Mercury Capri with her boyfriend, Wynne Cooper, listening to Ziggy Stardust when she was 14 and smoking weed. I love that image.
Yes. Yes.
And then this thing you mentioned, a former school friend says that she changed from being this kind of pretty cheerleader to being this kind of boho who didn't shave her legs.
Yes.
You know, and she was, I mean, I interviewed her once when she first came to England, and everybody was a hit, or just bubbling under.
Yeah.
And I say this, obviously I'm saying this as a sort of male interviewer. I was quite taken back by just the sheer, you know, this girl was going places, and you just she had a kind of extraordinary determination and pragmatism about her.
Yes.
I mean, tell us about Madonna and, you know, how you found writing a biography of her.
I think the most interesting thing for me when I was researching it, and I went to Detroit and spent some time in Michigan, you know, going to hanging out with some of her old school friends, her old boyfriend, doing like a recce of like the church she went to, the high school she went to, and talk. And what I found most fascinating was how she wasn't an alpha female. That, yeah, she had that whole cheerleading side, but she also was quite reserved and aloof as well. And there is a side to her. Well, certainly back then, it was like she was someone in waiting.
Mm-hmm.
So the Madonna that we see now was not there then. Mm-hmm. She was kind of, it was germinating. And it actually took quite a few years before that Madonna
New York exploded.
Yes. But those early years in New York weren't easy all.
But the New York, as far as the city has a personality, it was almost the personality she adopted for herself.
It was the right place for her to be.
It was the right place for her, yeah. But I think she'd done the work beforehand, in that she went to University of Michigan, she studied contemporary dance. And so she was coming at it, and she kind of hides this a little bit, but she is an intellectual, and she was coming at her work conceptually as like a pop artist. She loved Andy Warhol, and in a way, what she was doing was very conscious.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't, and I think that's what marks her out and makes her different from a lot of the, you know, more usual female stars.
Yeah.
Because she did have a critical apparatus around it.
I mean, also, you can say that, let's say she isn't the world's greatest singer, but as a singer, she has enormous personality. I was once asked to produce music for CD-ROMs for News Multimedia, and they wanted a track which sounded like Madonna. And it's quite easy to produce a track of that period that sounds like Madonna.
Yes.
But without Madonna, they're nothing.
No.
They are absolutely nothing.
Isn't it?
You know.
Yeah.
And while she's not a great singer, take her away and you literally have dust.
That's right. There's something she inhabits.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I have mixed feelings about Madonna. I can't say that I revere her in the way that I revere some of the female artists we've already talked about today.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
I would also say someone like Kate Bush, I'd say, just has a ton more musical talent.
Yes.
But Madonna's gifts are to do with kind of bringing all these different sort of media together and creating this persona.
There's only one record, which is the Immaculate Collection. Because that's actually her best stuff, which is her first four albums sort of thing. Her pursuit of whatever musical trend was going after that, I think, diluted her sort of the energy of what she does. But certainly those things, Papa Don't Preach, that sort of period of stuff are just fantastic records.
Well, we emailed a little bit yesterday, and I think some of her collaborators have been great. You could argue she's been a little too reliant on male collaborators. I don't know if that's a fair statement, but some of them have played a big part in her music, have they not?
She works very well one-to-one, you know, so her and William Orbit or Mirway.
Exactly, or the French guy, Mirway, that's it. Absolutely. And I think, you know, Pat Leonard as well, there was a lot of just the two of them writing together. Yes. I think Like a Prayer is probably musically the most impressive album she made. And you, of course, could say that has something to do with Pat Leonard. Would she have been able to write those songs without that input?
You know, the power of Madonna. I mean, and I had, it was great talking to Pat Leonard and Steve Bray about that Like a Prayer era, because that was when people first started looking and thinking, "Ooh, she's an artist."
Yes.
And I think basically each album is a story, it's a narrative, and it's autobiographical. It's where she is psychologically.
Yes.
And so Like a Prayer was about the patriarchy and Catholicism and her Catholic upbringing. So what she does is she has all those ideas swirling around her head and the lyrics and the melody, and then she works with someone who's a musician stroke producer like Pat Leonard, who can help make manifest and give depth to it and a whole sound to it.
Yes.
He said she came to him with the idea of a gospel choir, and she was there through the whole of all those studio sessions. So it was a very equal collaboration.
I mean, in a way, on her records, she's like the executive producer to her collaborators who are technically the producers.
Yes, that's right.
This affords a neat segue. We like segues in the RBP podcast. And right now, probably the biggest star on the planet is Taylor Swift. You can't say she's the new Madonna. She comes from a very different place. We thought it'd be amusing to just sort of investigate her back pages, really, and go back to, you know, the fact she really did start out in country. But already, that first album that she did, You hardly call it sort of traditional country music.
It was the country of that time.
Pop really sort of shading into just mainstream pop, you know. But she's massive. Just released a new album. We're featuring a review of that very first album that came out in 2006 by Jeff Tamarkin. And it does give her real kind of credit in terms of the fact she wrote these songs. She was 16. I think she was signed as a writer, as a songwriter. At the age of 14, you know, so she's precocious and then some. Whatever you think of her music, I mean, she has written certainly some, I think, really quite interesting lyrics.
I love it.
There's the old thing, I knew you were trouble, I think is magnificent. Obviously she's collaborated with this sort of, you know, the pop maestros like Max Martin, but you know, that's the reality of, if you want hits, you work with Max Martin, Ed Sheeran and so forth. You know, that's how you get these gigantic Spotify hits. I mean, I don't have a huge amount, so we're running three pieces. I've mentioned the review. There's an interesting Nick Hastert piece from 2009 about precisely the way country pop is moving ever closer to the mainstream of music. And then there's a great piece by Kate Mossman from The Word in 2010, where she goes to see Taylor at Wembley Arena. She's already like a massive star. She's selling out Wembley Arena. You know, thousands of hysterical schoolgirls are coming to worship this ostensibly country figure. Yeah. We don't really think of as country anymore. Yeah. But Kate has some fascinating like insights into the sort of what she calls the sort of cult of Taylor Swift.
That word's been used quite a lot. What is the cult of Taylor Swift?
Well,
what
I think this? So she says something quite interesting.
Like a sorority or something.
She says, she points out that there's this it's like paradox that Taylor Swift writes about the minutiae of her sort of romantic life.
Yes.
In almost like the way that Amy Winehouse did. Yes. She writes about boyfriends as if she's reading from her diary.
Yeah.
But then the spectacle of the Taylor Swift show is the sort of opposite of that. It's this huge sort of global superstar thing.
Ambition.
And massively ambitious. And then, of course, now there was a big Laura Snapes interview with her in The Guardian last weekend, which was about, among other things, it was about the sort of politicisation of, the belated politicisation of Taylor Swift. Because when Trump got in, she said nothing. And she claimed it because she was in a terrible state. And now now she's coming out, the single You Need to Calm Down is very, very sort of pro LGBT, you know.
She's more confident now.
I think so. I think
she's
so.
Had a certain amount of success and she's maturing.
So absolutely.
That gives women a lot of strength, I think. You know, if longevity gives you strength, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And, you know, in those early years, she was probably nervous about, oh, God, am I going to offend the good old boys, mm-hmm. particularly Nashville?
Yeah.
And then she was probably towing the line.
Having seen what happened to the Dixie chicks.
Exactly. So, but now she's probably feeling confident enough. Yeah. And she's a big enough star.
She's not going to lose her fan base.
No, that's the thing.
So I think she's. I mean, do you? So Shebop is in its third edition. Did you write about people like Taylor Swift in that?
She was just before. So the third edition came out 2013. She was just emerging at that point. Yeah. But it's going to be 25 years old next year.
Yeah.
And I think
you'll have to write about Taylor Swift.
I will, won't I? I think of Shebop as like a person now. She's not in the world doing her thing. And then every so often she comes back home again and says, hi, Mum. You know. Yeah. Cry, pretends he doesn't know that he's the reason why you're drowning, you're drowning, you're drowning.
Lucy, let's move on to another sort of female icon of the modern age. The week's audio interview is with Mark.
Yes, with Alicia Keys, Maureen Payton from 2010. For a starter, Maureen is not so much a music interview as a sort of personality interview. I assume it's done something like The Mail on Sunday.
Mm. Yeah, I think it would have been all The Express.
It's also a classic half hour in a hotel room somewhere. To be fair to Alicia Keys, she does send her PR people out, so there isn't somewhere to
hovering over.
But she, and Maureen, of course, asked the question, you know, are you seeing anyone at the moment? Which gets gets kicked into the long grass.
That's the thing we would have asked in our NME days. May I ask if you're seeing anyone? You're romantically linked.
Are you having sex with him?
Yes, yes. Who are you shagging, Alicia? I can't talk about that. I'd rather not mention. She says you can't even mention her brother.
That's the 1980s, isn't it? That's like typical tabloid, isn't it?
Well, it is typical tabloid.
She does talk about her family background, brought up by a mother and a grandmother. Mm. She got to know her father again and her stepbrother. Now, she doesn't really talk about much in terms of detail about it, saying how wonderful her childhood is. But at one point, Maureen asks her, was she ever tempted by the temptations of pop fame, like drugs, sex, blah, blah, blah. And we're also going to run a little clip, which is about her avoiding temptation. It's a very short clip, but she really lets you know where she was coming from in a way that she doesn't actually open up at all throughout the rest of the interview. Some people live for the fortune. Some people live just for the fame. Some people live the power, yeah.
Avoiding temptations in this business, I suppose we all know what they are, but how do you do it? You just sort of, you're very strong-minded.
No, I think that what does it for me on that side, I grew up around drugs, sex, alcohol, and death. And I think that when you see that in your life, you kind of know what it does to you, and it's really no desire to do it.
Yeah.
I don't have any desire. There's no... I'm fine.
Some people want it all, but I don't want nothing at all.
If it ain't you, baby, if I ain't got it, you, baby. I think that's pretty interesting. I mean, that is the nearest she gets to actually saying anything really about herself. A lot of the rest of it, she's going on about her Buddhism, her spiritual. She uses the word spiritual about 50 times in half an hour.
Yeah.
How she's blessed with love, about her charitable work, you know. Talks a bit about coping with fame. It's what it is. It's that type of interview.
Yeah. She sounds well-trained.
Yeah, and she sounds very...
And there's something a little enervating about listening to stars like that from the last... Because you just don't feel you're getting...
it. Well, I couldn't agree more.
I'm a massive R&B fan, and she's one of the least interesting R&B singers around. But just that moment, I thought, was pretty interesting.
Yes.
Like, she suddenly opens up to, this is where I'm coming from.
She
you
did.
Know, yeah. We're going to play a clip later on, which is Quincy Jones's advice. She was getting into doing production, film production, and was hoping to get into record production. and that's based on Quincy Jones's advice. He calls it where you earn money horizontally, not in that sort of sense. Yeah. But the idea.
I've never heard it quite put,
no,
like
put
that,
that way. But essentially, you can put your feet up on a sofa and you're earning money because yeah. you're getting royalties from all the stuff right. you've done for other people.
Yeah.
So that's Alicia Keys.
Yeah. Great. Yeah. all right. Shall we talk then about everything that's new on RBP yeah. for subscribers?
I mean, I'll rattle through this fairly
quickly. Rattle through.
Dawn James interviewing the Small Faces, in this particular case, Kenny Jones from Rave 1965, and he says, it would be wonderful to have enough money and not to worry anymore. We've come from homes where money has never been plentiful. Well, A, that's true. B, they weren't making any money because Don Arden was taking them off
yes.
solidly.
Yeah.
I mean, they were on like £10 a week wages with records in the top 10. I mean, it was just scandalous.
Yeah.
There's a pretty good interview with The Temptations by Phil Simms in Disc from January 73, around the time of Papa's Rolling Stone, with the hilarious headline, Hitler's Part in the Rise of the Temps.
Hitler.
Explain.
The group referred to Norman Whitfield affectionately as Hitler.
Oh, God. What's that programme? It could only happen in the 70s. Yeah,
yeah. Norman Hitler Whitfield. Yeah. To believe it. Papa was a rolling stone. Wherever he laid his hat was his home.
Really interesting Tim Lott interview with Iggy Pop from Record Mirror in 1977, when Iggy, I don't know if Iggy's still using drugs in 77.
He's not a full-blown smack addict.
But anyway, he's virtually impossible to interview. That's the thing you get. And Tim Lott is a fan, and he's really struggling. Iggy comes up with stuff like, violence is an indulgence. It's the modern counterpart of Augustus Tiberius and strawberries sent down from the Swiss Alps by runners. Iced.
God bless Iggy. Who else would give you quotes like that?
But then this ends with this great reaching the rainbow, because he's playing the rainbow that night. We get out of the coach. Iggy comes up and puts an arm around me. His other arm holds a very large glass jug filled with ice and orange juice. Well, Tim, he croons, are you coming to the sound check? Okay. Well, that's mighty gracious of you. He flings the glass jug in the middle of Blackstock Road, spraying jagged glass chunks and ice cubes all over the white lines and tarmac. He stalks off in an inexplicable rage. If he weren't such a stinking genius, I'd say he had a head filled to the brim with shaving foam and pig's droppings. But somewhere in that crazy garbage is something really beautiful. Listen for it. I mean... That sort of tells you what the whole interview is.
And this
like.
Is on the back of The Idiot, where he really has, thanks to Bowie, he's established a new kind of place for himself, hasn't he? I mean, I saw him on that tour, and it was a different kind of Iggy.
Yeah.
That was a great record, Lost for Life record.
Yeah. I remember seeing him at Leeds University.
Right.
At that time.
You had a magazine there, didn't you?
I worked on Leeds Student.
Lead student, that's
which
it, sorry,
was,
yeah, yeah.
The editorship was a sabbatical position, so it was actually quite well funded.
Back
in the good old
Leeds
days.
Leeds was an important music town, wasn't it?
Yeah. The reason I went was because of the music.
Yeah.
Bands like Gang of Four, of Delta Five.
Yeah.
Lemmy interview by Phil Sutcliffe in Sound 79. Lemmy's just a great interviewee. I mean, it's just things like, that was a great thing about the mod movement first time round. We used to have quite long hair and we really knew how to comb it.
And associate Lemmy with comb.
Yeah, well, then he, talking about his own appearance, even a pig's ear would be too complimentary. Look at this, the face that sank a thousand ships. You know. it's always. Now, this other one is Amy Grant. Do you know anything about Amy Grant? Christian rock star.
Does she appear? Yeah. Do you write about female Christian rockers?
Yeah, I think she does make an appearance in Shebop, and she's made an appearance in a couple of things I've written.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I mean, because this is only the second piece we've ever found by one of our writers. Michael Goldberg, Rolling Stone in 85. And she comes out with all kinds of anti-abortion stuff. She's really hardcore. But she likes the idea of being sexy but within marriage. You know, it's this sort of thing. It's just, my hormones are just as on key as any other 24-year-old's. I know the deep need in a marriage for sex. But then she's really disapproving of Prince basically humping on stage. She says, if someone wants to do this at home, fine. If I want to do this at home, fine. I don't want to watch Prince doing it.
I remember that interview.
Do
I
you?
Reading that at the time.
Well, you probably did part of your research.
Yes.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's interesting. It's slightly dispiriting. I mean, but there you go.
But it's interesting to read about someone like Amy Grant from that era, well, at a time now when Christian fundamentalism is back with a vengeance. Yeah. And I assume
and
there
abortion
are,
is outlawed. And, well,
and
no.
I mean, exactly.
It's all her fault. It's all Amy Grant's fault.
Amy Grant's fault.
I remember it was a National Abortion Campaign rally that I first saw Gang of Four and Delta Five play
right?
live. They were on the back of a lorry.
Fantastic.
And Amy Grant was not on the bill.
No. But, you know, it's interesting. That issue never goes away.
Oh, my God. It's terrifying.
Jump forward to July 1999. Tim Westwood had been shot at about a week before. He was driving his car and some guy shot
him. Sure he didn't stage his own shooting?
that's another sort of debate entirely. It's Barbara Ellen, who's writing I adore. She's talking about the way in which white people will take on black personas, will listen to black music. The reverse is very rarely true. You don't get any, except, you know, Skunk and Nancy and Skin.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But it starts with, a friend of mine was at the Notting Hill Carnival a couple of years ago and happened to catch Radio 1 DJ Tim Westwood in action. According to her, Westwood had barely begun when he suddenly started directing the crowd. All you white people, go to the back, and all my black brothers, come down to the front. Westwood was also said to be very fond of employing the word niggas in a positive way when addressing his friends and acquaintances. We should all be very fine and funky were it not for the fact that Westwood is the 42-year-old son of the former Bishop of Peterborough, and frankly, my dear, as white as cocaine.
Right.
It's very funny. I mean, I find Barbara Ellen writing about music, I find her very, very amusing. And she does. I remember once Frank Broughton and Bill Bruce and I were kind of driving back or something and talking about Tim Westwood, and Frank was fantasising about what Tim Westwood would be, how he had talked to his father over a meal in the restaurant, you know?
Well, the Bishop of Peterborough.
Bishop of Peterborough.
I have this one abiding memory of Tim Westwood being stuck in traffic on the Marylebone Road, and also stuck like in the lane next to me was Westwood in the sort of Westwood mobile. So he's sitting there, of course, playing very, very loud hip hop, and with sort of Westwood written all over this vehicle, and it was just so sad.
Yeah.
It looked, he looked so absurd, and he has become such an absurd figure, hasn't
he? Like a character, isn't it? It's like Ali G almost.
Well, I think he was a big inspiration for Ali G.
But without the humour.
He's in no humour at all.
Remarkably humourless man, you know, very, very full of himself. You know, people like David Rodigan have sort of pulled off the trick of being a white DJ around black music. Mm. And by and large done it quite well. Though Rodigan's had his Westwood moments. No doubt there's a documentary quite recently on television where you watch how some of it through your fingers from behind a sofa. But Tim Westwood, the idea of a white DJ blackening up. Mm. I mean, it's kind of reverse black and white minstrel show sort of stuff.
It's like he is like the jerk. He doesn't realise that he's
white.
Well,
she talks about the jerk in the piece. Precisely.
Remember
that.
Steve Martin.
She actually mentions that in relation to this. Yeah. So anyway,
I suppose what a lot of the black artists that he's featured respect him because basically he's carved out a space for them.
I think they respect him because he helps
radio.
Them sell records.
Yeah.
I wouldn't put it much beyond that.
That's the name
brutally.
Of the game.
Yeah.
You know.
Same with David.
I saw Eminem at 2001 at the Docton's Arena, and Westwood was the DJ, and it was excruciating. He was talking about the girls' thongs and all sort of stuff. It really was eye-wateringly awful. Anyway, that's my contribution.
Well,
you got any
I think it's probably time to wrap up,
but not without
thanking our special guest Lucy O'Brien, and not without bigging up. To use a sort of
Westwood,
bigging up. Everything that Lucy's done.
She's a white artist who collaborated and works a lot with black artists.
Yeah. Absolutely.
But she did it in a way that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
You know, she was so respectful.
We got a very early interview with her. I think she was still the Springfields, and she'd just been to America for the first time. And she said how she sat in her room listening to these soul records. And she's talked about these soul records. This is like 1963 or something like that. Yeah. And her love of black music just oozes out.
Well, and you quote P.P. Arnold, who's recently enjoyed
Arnold.
A kind of renaissance.
Yeah.
Who's wonderful.
Yeah.
And you said, I mean, she says she was Dusty was the soul singer.
Yes, yes, that's right. It's,
I mean, yeah. They were good. I mean, yeah. Look, even Cilla Black was a pretty great singer. Do you know Sandy Shaw?
I think what's interesting about the dynamic is that Dusty worked with them and she lived it.
Yeah.
You know, she lived it and she had them singing with her. She learnt so much from them.
She's more of a soul singer, for example, than Dionne Warwick is a soul singer.
I think that's right.
Even though they were working in not dissimilar territories. I mean, I could imagine Dusty working with Bacharach and David.
And she did some, exactly.
Yeah. But she's a distinctly more soulful singer than Dionne Warwick, even though I love Dionne Warwick.
She had that power behind it.
Yeah.
But also emotional. This is a sort of emotional.
We do recommend you rush out and buy Dusty the Classic Biography by Lucy O'Brien, as well as, of course, Shebop. Shebop 3. Yes. I don't know if you call it Shebop 3. Is it Shebop 3 now? I've got Shebop 2 in front of me.
It's actually Shebop, the Definitive History of Women in Popular Music, and just third edition. But I just want to say, if people are listening to this before the 4th of September, I'm doing a special Dusty night at the Dublin Castle. Rock and Roll Book Club are hosting it.
Oh, great.
So do come along, and if you go on to We Got Tickets, you'll see Dusty the Classic Biography, and do come along.
Oh, fantastic.
It'd be lovely to meet you.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming in. It's been really, really brilliant.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed it.
Wonderful. Well, I know that you guys will be here next week. I won't. I'll be on holiday.
Lucky
but
swine.
You are welcoming next week's guest, David Stubbs.
David Stubbs is coming
brilliant.
In.
Brilliant.
To talk about, among other things, Slade, Francis Rossi, and, of course, David's own career and his own books.
Yes,
and
Mars, Maker by 19,
and Mars by 1980.
Mars by 1980.
Mars by 1875.
Mars by 2018, whatever.
Mars.
That's going to be very jolly. I just come back from holiday. He's just going on holiday.
This is how we do things.
We're lazy swine here.
We're not allowed to take holidays at the same time. Of course.
But, all together.
Tune in next week. Hope you've enjoyed this. We've loved having Lucy here. Thanks again. See you soon.
Bye.
Actually, it's amazing. Way more amazing. Quincy Jones told me. He basically said, try to figure out how to make horizontal money. And horizontal money is money that you make while you're laying down.
Sure.
So, in being in the spotlight, you have to be everywhere, you have to appear, you have to be there, it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
And if you're able to help other people find wonderful things in themselves and help them to get their chance, then you're able to do many things.
Which meant laying down, meaning
something. Meaning sleeping, relaxing, chilling on the couch, sleeping, watching television, whatever it is you might be doing.
Yeah.
That was Alicia Keys in conversation with Maureen Payton in 2010, concluding this week's Rock's Back Pages podcast. Many thanks to special guest Lucy O'Brien. The new edition of Dusty, the Classic Biography, is out now and published by Michael O'Mara Books. Find Lucy's other work online at lucyobrien.co.uk. The hosts were Barney Hoskins and Mark Pringle, and the producer was Jasper Murison Bowie. You can find thousands of articles, as well as hundreds of full-length audio interviews, at rocksbackpages.com.